the theme for the evening talk is impressions and reality. I believe the first time I came here to Israel was in 1992 or 93, and I've had the joy and privilege of coming back every year around this time. And in the wealth of experiences and observations that take place, they in fact continue right through to the time one finally gets on the aeroplane at Tel Aviv airport to fly out. And some of you will have had this experience at Tel Aviv airport of being asked rather a lot of questions. And some of you think there's rather a lot asked by me during an inquiry period, but it's really small change compared with what these young men and women like to ask when one's departing. And over the years one rather gets used to it, but I remember on my last visit in July, last July, there's usually a young man and a young woman, and then who's 19, 20 years of age, and then behind that person there's a person who's a bit older, a kind of guru for the interrogators. So they said, you know, why did you come to Israel? And I said, well, for falafels and hummus. And the young woman said, hummus? No. You like hummus? No. I know my Hebrew is not very good, but at least I'm sure there's a difference between hummus and hummus. And from that very poor beginning, it gradually got worse. And two of my friends, Rowan and Tammy, who live in the Jerusalem, I had stayed with them. So the two questioners, inquisitors or whatever, said they needed to ring them to confirm that they knew me and I had been there. And it didn't help at all, because I just couldn't remember the name of the place here where I'd been for 10 days. Just couldn't think of the name of it. So all I could tell them was I was on the edge of the Negev desert, and then they said, well, who do you know on the edge of the Negev desert? etc. So then, unfortunately, not having the telephone number of Rowan and Tammy, so then they told me to wait there, and then they went off for their own Camp David and came back 10 or 15 minutes later, and then decided that I should be taken off to another room for further questioning. So when I got to this other room and brought all my baggage and my suitcases with me, I unpacked every single detailed item, did a forensic investigation of my dirty underpants, and every single item they took apart. It took best part of an hour. And then with the bag, they put that through the X-ray machine and put all the items of clothing through there, and the shampoo through there, and everything. I never had such special treatment in my entire life there. And the time was going by for the aeroplane, and eventually they took me and then hurried through the immigration, etc., etc. Well, and I thought, this, it seems like, because for the visitors to this country, in various ways, in varying degrees, many seem to go through this procedure, and there are plenty of areas of places in conflict in the world, Pakistan with India, with Kashmir, and Sri Lanka, and Tamils and Sinhalese, and Northern Ireland and England, etc., etc. And one just left wondering, it's just an impression, that sometimes that final impression of the visit here is the one that lots of people tend to make reference to. And I would like to think that with good Hebrew hospitality, there must be a few people around to say, oh, look, if someone's going to be a terrorist, they're not going to go through Tel Aviv airport. They go through somewhere which is much easier, obviously. And all they have to do is just put it through the machine and see what's running through the machine, and just do the body shirt and metal detector. I mean, but this questioning, it leaves impressions, and rather unsatisfactory ones. And I don't know if yourselves as Israeli passport holders get subject to the same degree, but I just use it how in the world that we live in, how easy the impression can become the last residue of the way we think about something, or about a place, or about a person, or about a set of circumstances, and how easily in life, with impressions that take place, they can leave a kind of residue, and in that prevent us from seeing more clearly, prevent us from looking beyond the impression. And when they build up in the psyche, in the emotional life and the mental life, etc., there's a greater solidity which begins to come to them, and we begin to look at our world and our individuals and groups and nations and circumstances through the impression. And we begin to imagine that the impression itself is the reality. And in Dharma language, we cut ourselves off from having a deeper access to things. In the East, occasionally with the Buddha, more often in the Vedanta tradition of Shankara, the word which many of you will be familiar with is, which is used, is Maya, M-A-Y-A, and quite often, partly as a legacy from the European scholars when they were translating the languages of Pali and Sanskrit, translated it as an illusion. We heard the word today in the inquiry, the word illusion, but in its root meaning it means to measure. And easily and frequently impressions build up, and they are a kind of measurement of a situation, and then through the measurement we begin to believe the measurement, that means the movement of the self, to the degree that that's how we think things really are. And then the life becomes a consistent activity, mental activity, emotional feeling activity, a consistently measuring, and people measuring up against each other, people measuring themselves with how they are today and how they were yesterday and how we would like to be tomorrow. And that world of measuring, inwardly and outwardly, becomes what we regard as the true reality of things. And therefore the East has said, in being imprisoned in all of this, we live in Maya. We live in Maya. We live in the pattern of measuring. And it is no easy task for us to look at that and question that and see what the relative usefulness is and what the limited one is. What the relative use is and what the limited one is. And the relative use, of course, in just in kilometers, those kind of measurements, has a usefulness. But sometimes the self, in its conditioning, again we were hearing with one of the inquiries today, keeps turning its attention to the past, and in the movement of its attention it selects and it picks out events from the past. It brings the current mind state to those past events and it forms an impression of how things were. It's got engaged in selection. You and I think of all the things that happen to us every day. Think of all the impressions that come to us through our eyes and ears, billions and millions of them. And the mind moves inwardly, in this case to past, to memory, picks out a handful. The movement carries with it beliefs, whatever, negativity, reactivity, conditioning, and the two forces of moving to the past and the inner movement that goes along with it comes together and it generates a new set of impressions. When we do that with a certain intensity, the impressions act as a kind of weight inwardly. Impressions are not light things. When they accumulate and they act as a weight, and in that weight we can feel incredible pressure in our emotions, we can feel very depressed, we can feel extraordinarily unhappy. All of that is impressions which you and I must experience and must live with and must accept and acknowledge, but given such authority that we can't see them as impressions, we see it as reality. And because we fail to see it as an impression, the weight gathers and one can have a very heavy day, a very miserable day, a very hard day, a very difficult day. And it's got to do with the way we perceive the impressions, brought together with tendencies, maybe resistance, maybe views or whatever, and the weight of the day, the weight of the circumstance, the weight of the place, the weight of the silence, the weight of a relationship, past or present or whatever it might be, all seems to impact on us. So Dharma teachings and practices are a reminder to us, and it isn't easy, but a reminder to us to treat and to regard as much as possible an impression as an impression. So today, no doubt most of us in our realms of sitting and walking, etc., may have experienced some area of our life which is occurring, may require some attention to. We've had some thoughts about it, some feelings, some ideas about it, etc. Are we able to treat those as impressions? Can we feel a certain spaciousness and lightness about them? If we can, and we can develop that, it's going to change our life extraordinarily. Because we know an impression as an impression. somebody very kindly today brought me a copy of the Jerusalem Post. Not quite the most liberal-minded newspaper I've ever read, I should add. And while looking at the cover, concerned with the whatever efforts to make some agreement there, surprise, surprise, the Prime Minister said that, I can't remember, maybe not quoting precisely here, but essentially it was very difficult to come to an agreement because Palestinian leader Mr. Arafat was making difficult demands and therefore having a struggle to find some common ground. And surprise, surprise, what did Mr. Arafat say? So the difficulty where impressions may be taking place, both may be right, both may be wrong, maybe both are neither right nor wrong because they have impressions or that other people, that means the people who are their spokesperson for, have different impressions. So maybe neither can do much because neither actually has much authority to do anything. And these difficult, convoluted, troublesome situations in our life and in our life of people who represent us as well, it's going to require from all of us a lot of fresh ways of looking into things. And you and I might say, well, why can't they come to an agreement? But sometimes we have to take a look in our own life. And we say, why can't we come to an agreement with people that we don't like, or we find it difficult to be with, or we find our neighbour is troublesome and we're troublesome, etc. So inner work requires in that a really looking at impressions, a really clear and honest looking at what clinging is, and can we learn, and this is part of what we do here, can we find ways and learn what it is to help focus the mind on the bare actuality. And that focusing of the mind and a certain single-pointedness of the mind may be a helpful resource for us to begin to work through and cut through some of the impressions and go deeper. In the tradition, it's called Samadhi, S-M-A-A-D-H-I. And Samadhi means a focused attention, a certain single-pointedness to it, a non-indulgence in pictures and stories and fantasies and soap operas and the speculations and the views and opinions one has about anything and everything, and keeping rather steadfastly focused on the immediacy of things, and therefore it's giving attention, bare attention to the bare moment. It's a skill and it's a learning in life to be quite singularly focused in that way, so that we're not just a prisoner of what our mind keeps producing. Sometimes people come and regularly, first days of a retreat situation, even with previous experience, and see the mind and see, wow, just how out of control it is. That one is grateful. They haven't developed a video for one's mind. Can you imagine if we could just put a strap on ourselves and press a button, then we, all right, today we'll watch this person's mind, and it goes up on a big screen behind, and what just goes on in the space of 45 minutes in the mind. And then we come in, then we go out, and then we're back again. Breath? Forget it. Nose? What's that? Breathing, body? What's that? And what one has got, this is this huge projection. Not even in Hollywood, which has to be one of the epicenters of bizarre world, can compare with what the mind can do. What it can generate. Anything. Whole inner life becomes a comedy of errors. And in this production that goes on, and sometimes it is a shock, say, goodness, how is my mind producing this? It's not like we walk in the meditation room and we sit down and we say, right, I think for this period of time I'll make my mind worse than a Stephen King movie. Horror movie, that means. Or I'll have another great huge fantasy about saving all sentient beings later in life. Just one sits or walks and this production goes on. And when there's no idea what nor where nor how, it all comes together to do what it does. And that investment in it and the self's identification with it and the reinforcement of it, the layers of it go either backwards on oneself, as we were hearing earlier on today in the inquiry, or it gets extended out in particulars and generalizations. Good, bad, and indifferent. Towards oneself, towards others, towards life, towards circumstances. And all of it seems to be a kind of internalized production. And we think, how on earth are we ever going to find what reality is if we're living in that day in and day out? Not only living in it, but living out of it. And many things that one starts off doing can easily start off just from a fantasy. And so sometimes one has a fantasy in terms of career. When I have done this, I will become this. And then I will have succeeded in this. And if there isn't any depth to it of vision and focus and single-pointedness, plenty of people, I meet plenty of people, started off with a fantasy about what something would be like, get into enormous debt, student grants, the like. I have one dear friend in America, trained to be a lawyer, $88,000 in debt, paying off student loans. Soon there'll be these loans and debts that people find themselves in. It would be that the West will have to start believing in rebirth, just for the length of time going to be needed to pay off the student loans and the mortgage and all these other things. So see, sometimes the mind creates something, said it would be really great to do this. Not in touch with vision, not in touch with concentrated, single-pointed focus, just in touch with an idea, a daydream, follows it through with some energy. And sometimes, when that happens, and it happens regularly, the fruits come, and the person may feel incredibly unhappy. In their work, in their relationship, or whatever it else it may be. So working more deeply with ourselves, and the willingness and development of training ourselves in focusing and single-pointedness will help to get us much more steady, to see things much more clearly. And also, and equally important with that, is that then perhaps there's a real energy for something which is deep, meaningful and valuable, and there is a single-pointed energy to go with it, to respond to that vision, to respond to that priority. And all of that has a direct bearing and a direct relationship in our life to training the mind to be focused and single-pointed. So that when something arises which we feel and sense is valuable and is important, we genuinely can follow it through. Because there are far too many people wandering around on the earth who feel very much unfulfilled. Very much a feeling in life that their potential to be creative, their potential to express, their potential to serve others, their potential to live well within themselves, isn't happening. And it isn't happening because something is going on inwardly in the world of impressions and pleasures and pains, which is preventing inwardly focus, attention, steadiness, cutting through impressions, for something to flow through. And there's nothing, I think, particularly mystical about that. I think it's much more an outcome of development. Our society doesn't give any training in any of this. Society is so uncivilized, it just doesn't know the ways and means of exploring in depth to really bring the fullness out of a human being. Some people have it naturally, and it is there with them as a natural attribute, and it's lovely always to meet such people, and that's reflected in those people's happiness and contentment and peace of being and wisdom with life. But I think we would probably agree it's definitely a minority in our society. Sometimes with the impressions which arise there, any kind of impression which has a generalized view about it, please nuke it. Any kind of impression where we generalize about it. And sometimes, and tragically of course, can occur with groups of people, known and unknown to us. And it takes just a lot of stopping, and anything which has a general rule for us to be able to stop and to say, are there exceptions to the rule? Are there exceptions? And if we look carefully, we'll keep seeing exceptions. And if we look more and more carefully, we'll end up seeing so many exceptions, it will deny the rule. You may have an impression about what everybody else is here is like today. It's very hard to draw an accurate impression, because if people are not talking, one's got to rely mostly on what the eye tells us. And some will say, the most miserable lot I've ever had to spend a day with in my entire existence. And therefore there's the generalized view. And the impression, like coloured sunglasses, we carry. And we keep looking. So one person looks rather serious, and one person's perhaps sitting on a chair with their hands like this, or perhaps there's a person who's in tears, or a person who seems rather hurried and a bit aggressive, or whatever it might be. And because we've already got the coloured sunglasses on, seeing everything darkly, so to speak, we keep looking for the confirmation. And then that becomes a way to reinforce the view. But what if we said, I've been doing that my whole life. Hopeless way of living. What would it be to do is say, well, let me look and see if there are exceptions. The person looks content, relaxed, at home with them, with themselves, walking easily and comfortably, dedicated to the day, respectful to the process of things, etc. Let me see if there's a person who comes here in here before the sitting begins, who stays longer, or whatever it might be. Let me listen to the people who speak in a small group, or come to the inquiry with their investigations, etc. And sometimes when we do all of this, not for the sake of other people, but just for the sake that in the doing of it, it actually opens up our life. We actually begin to say, this existence is extraordinarily diverse. Breathtakingly diverse. And can we sense it and feel it and know it? That will open up our inner life. Just because we're not going to rest and cling to an impression. To repeat myself a little bit, the concentration factor in the meditation, the samadhi factor, the single-pointedness, the training of the mind for that, can genuinely offer a way of cutting through that to open up the life more. In that inner movement of exploring and opening up the life, sometimes you'll have to make a bit of sacrifice en route to do that. A person will sometimes say, oh, when I do the walking meditation, I don't like doing it, because when I'm doing it, I'm cutting out seeing the flowers and the lovely day and the green grass, etc., because I'm just concentrating on the foot touching the ground, so I'm missing out on a lot of things. To a degree it's true when you walk along in that way, But if one is willing to make a little external sacrifice and willing to say to oneself, can I give attention to the diversity of sensations that go on with the body and go on right under the foot as my foot touches the ground, and make that a fairly single-pointed focus? Could that single-pointed focus and that awareness of change and impermanence and coming and going and different vibrations, sensations and pressures and tingling and throbbing, in all of that, I can keep steady with that. As I open out, perhaps it will reveal a great deal more to me. Just through that quality of attention. A few months ago I was in Australia, and we were there's a Tibetan meditation center, well off the beaten track. It was in a place 21 kilometers long, a track from a place called Kyogle. My mother came to she'd done a weekend retreat before, so this was an 8-day retreat, and it was the time of her 80th birthday. And whether or not any of you have been to Australia or not, but one thing that one has in Australia is diversity of the species. That means what's on the ground and in the air. And within 20-30 meters of the meditation hall in the middle of nowhere, because Tibetans love the middle of nowhere, having spent many centuries living in the middle of nowhere. And within meters of the hall there was scorpions, I know what you have here. There was black and brown snakes, both are poisonous, but they both have two completely different temperaments. Just because some of you might be going to Australia, you might like to know this. The black snake is timid. It's a little bit like humans, some humans. It's timid. You get close to it, day or night, it will move away pretty quickly. These are the red-bellied black snakes, they're called. But the brown snake looks much the same in the dark, I have to say. Completely different temperament. It will not move out of the way for anybody. If you get close, it will bite. And there's a little concern there, because we're 21 kilometers from the road, and then another 15-20 kilometers from any kind of clinic, etc. So we said to the yogis, meditators, please, what? Be mindful. Very simple. The valuable thing about having a few little threats around it, the quality of the mindfulness goes up significantly. And then we had very long lizards, what they call them. The black one, wasn't it? Very long goannas, and they had very long goannas there. I don't know if you know what a goanna is. Very long with claws. And when I started the retreat that evening, my opening words were, "Welcome to Jurassic Park." And one person, one woman, doing her standing meditation, because many Australians, they live in cities and don't have much contact with the rural nature, doing her standing meditation, and this goanna, 2 meters long, plodding, walking towards her. And I said to her, look, get out of the way. And she's just watching. Because anything which stands upright in the mind of a goanna is a tree. And once those things are on you, it's not the kind of intimate relationship that one would like to enjoy. And in the end, there were two of us shouting at her from about 3 meters away, get out of the way. Because once it's on, the only way you can get it off is by lying flat, and it realizes you're not a tree, and it will get off you. But meanwhile, it's... So my mother was on this retreat. The meditation hall, and her, where she was sleeping, like here, a good 100, 150 meters away. There was not a more mindful meditator on that retreat than my mother. I promise you, she did not put a single foot down for 8 days without examining first where it was going. And all my friends and the retreatants were just so impressed with me. So inspired with my mother. They got a new guru. So sometimes outer circumstances called scorpions and black snakes and brown snakes and goannas, etc., etc., bring out a certain focus, a certain concentration, a certain single-pointed attention, a certain willingness to be really present. But when we're in a pretty safe environment such as here, then it has to come very much from within. Learning to be steady, focused, single-pointed, step by step, step by step. Even in the walking up and down, and even when we say to ourselves, I'm just walking up and down, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm walking up and down, and it isn't leading anywhere. And one may have initially some kind of reaction to that. Why walk up and down? It's not going anywhere. If there is a certain single-pointed focus and attention, and if one is willing to stay with walking up and down and there's nowhere to go, maybe a deeper reality, a deeper truth of things will begin to reveal itself. It's that important. The normal mind says, oh, I start off at A and I walk along and I arrive at point B, as though we really have gone somewhere. Is there anywhere we can go? Is there anywhere to go? What would it be not to just dismiss that, but to rest in the simple here and now truth of things, and to see if there is some profound realization that's possible? To see that in the cutting through the measuring, oh, I was there and it was like that, and now I'm here and it's like this, and therefore a measuring of the mind which is taking place. What if we were willing to put that aside, even though it helps us to function, I know that, even though it helps us to talk, I know that, except I was here, now I'm here, now I'm going there. But what would it be if just temporarily we put aside all the measuring, we developed our single-pointedness, our concentration and our focus, and we allowed ourselves to respond, well, it's not leading anywhere and I'm not going anywhere. I'm just walking up and down. I'm just standing. I'm just sitting here, but I'm not really doing anything. Could it make and generate a receptivity to another way of discovery what this life essentially is? which all of our doing and all of our impressions may be obstructing us from realizing. That's what sitting is about, what walking is about, what standing is about, what being vigilant and aware of measuring, even though it's got relative human conventional usage, obviously. Perhaps we discover a reality which is extraordinarily liberating. And we know the world of measurement, but we're not deceived by it. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings be